Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Wylie Theater, and welcome to all of you that are joining us on Teams and Facebook Live for this TRADOC Leader Professional Development webinar. I'm Mike Prevost from the Knowledge Management Office here at TRADOC, and we're thrilled to have you join us today as we delve into the topic of cultivating a data-literate workforce. Our esteemed guest, Mr. Mike Formica, the Executive Deputy to the Commanding General at TRADOC, will be sharing his insights, expertise, and examples on how the command is using data to enable decision-making here at TRADOC headquarters. As the CG's civilian advisor, Mr. Formica is responsible for the long-term management and investments of TRADOC, as well as organizing business operations and managing the civilian workforce. His extensive experience and strategic vision will provide invaluable context for our discussion on data literacy. We're equally delighted to welcome Mr. Jordan Morrill, a renowned author and data analytics leader who has traveled all the way from Utah to share his wisdom with us today. Often referred to as the godfather of Army data literacy, Jordan brings a wealth of knowledge and passion to this field. He's the author of several influential books on this subject, including Be Data Literate, which is widely seen as the Army's approach to data literacy. His upcoming book, Business 101 for the Data Professional, is eagerly anticipated and set to be released soon. Together, Mr. Formica and Mr. Morrill will engage in a conversation about the significance of data literacy in today's data-centric world. They'll explore how being data literate can empower individuals, teams, and organizations to make informed decisions, drive innovation, and ultimately gain a competitive edge. As we embark on this journey to understand the importance of data literacy, we encourage you to ask questions, share your thoughts, and think about how becoming more comfortable with reading, working, analyzing, and communicating with data can help you make an impact on your part of the organization and work smarter, not harder. So without further ado, I'll hand it off to Mr. Formica for opening comments. Mr. Formica.
Hey, Mike, thanks. Can you all hear me? Okay. All right, thanks. Thanks, Mike, for that kind introduction. I'm not sure esteemed's the right adjective. Maybe it's steamed, that's for sure. But look, it's wonderful to see so many folks during their lunch hour here. And you're not eating in the auditorium, so I understand you've forsaken that opportunity. But it's great to see you here. And I just want to say up front, and I think the CKO team made sure I would say this, you don't have to be a mathematician or a data scientist to get into this, and we all need to understand it better. And we are blessed today to have Jordan here to help us better appreciate what data means to us. Aside from the fact that it is one of the Secretary of the Army's imperatives that the Army become more data analytically in making and informing decisions, it's important to TRADOC. And I just want to sort of set the stage so that you as action officers or branch or division chiefs can appreciate why it matters and why you becoming data literate matters to us, all right? And I'm going to use a current example. And I don't know if anybody's in here from the Surgeon General's office. And if you are, please don't take offense to what I'm going to do in talking about a task that you're working. But look, the Army's got a good problem. The problem is recruiting has exceeded capacity in the United States Army right now, capacity for basic combat training. And so we've done the analysis. Do we got enough drill sergeants? Well, yeah. And we've also done the analysis. We need to have them at this ratio of drill sergeant to soldier. Otherwise, we get significant attrition or bad behavior in formations. So, yes, we got enough drill sergeants, and the Army's working to make sure that we grow enough to meet the emerging problem. Do we got enough DFACs in barracks? Yes, we do. All right. Do we have enough support personnel? Kind of. So let me give you the example. The example is medical support personnel. That's why I said the Surgeon General's office. So as part of a program called TRADOC Operation, whatever TOM stands for, okay, which is, what's it stand for? TRADOC Organizational Medical Support, which we initiated about 4 years ago, in which we used data to justify the growth of this or these organizations at our basic combat training locations. Okay, that data indicated that if you have medic staff inside of BCT formations, basic combat training, the attrition rate goes down because you get a soldier looked at more quickly by a medical professional, he gets put on a rehabilitative program, and he gets to stay in the curriculum and he doesn't cycle out, recycle out, okay? And, oh, by the way, it costs a lot of money to recruit a soldier. I'm not going to say how much because I'm not absolutely sure, but it's more than like $1,000. It costs a lot of money. So every time you go up a percentage point in attrition, you're losing money. Plus, you're not putting a soldier in a formation inside of Forces Command. So when we have to grow, we need to be able to say we need more medics. And so what the team is doing right now is looking at that historical data, and they're going to give me predictive analysis, okay, that's going to share if we don't get more medics, this is what we think the attrition rate is going to be in the United States Army, okay? And I am just literate enough to ask those kinds of questions, okay? And I want you to become literate enough to understand that data and to be able to ask those kinds of questions and then help me with that information justify the resource requirements we need in TRADOC to be able to do the tasks that we have or share what we think the outcome will be because we've got the data that will help us appreciate, no, we're going to have an attrition of XXXX soldiers at this amount of money that aren't going into formation, okay? So that's just an example to help bring you into the conversation and whet your appetite, which is already probably whetted because you're in the theater, okay? So glad to do that and looking forward to gaining a better appreciation from our subject matter expert, Jordan here, who, oh, by the way, that is a West Point shirt, okay? On an individual that is into fitness, as you can see as well, all right? And he is, you heard, no stranger to the United States Army. As I spoke to him, he's worked at Fort Liberty, he's worked at Fort Moore, and he's been out to Fort Leavenworth as well. And so we are blessed, sir, to have you here today. And I'll turn this over to you to help better illustrate what we should be thinking about.
Yeah, thank you. I'm super happy to be here at Fort Eustis today. I've been working with the Army now, as he just mentioned, for over 3 years, advising, consulting, traveling around, talking, whether it's data strategy, data literacy, which is my baby, and the opportunity to share more thoughts on it with you today and give you a call to action that as TRADOC launches their data literacy course today, that you sign up and do that. Now, Mr. Formica said something very, very important. You don't have to be a data scientist. You don't have to be as nerdy as I am, okay? Let's just put that out there. What we want is that you develop a confidence and comfort in using data. By show of hands, and sorry if you're online, you can raise your hand, but you might be the only one in the room doing it. How many of you in here would consider yourself data literate? Everybody raise your hand. How many of you use your weather app to figure out? Like I traveled yesterday, I was keynoting at an event in Chicago, so I needed to see the weather in Chicago. I had major flight issues getting here last night, so I'm figuring out data that way. We're always using data and information to make decisions. And so as the Army is putting forth resources for you to utilize data, don't think you have to become a statistician. You don't need to learn machine learning and coding unless you want to, and then, hey, reach out to me. I'll help you out. But the reality is what we want you to do is become comfortable. Make it a part of your work, not in addition to your work, so that you can read, work with, analyze, and communicate with data. I've been on the data, I helped invent this entire space all the way back in 2016, traveled the world on it, and I work with organizations all over the world. And the organization that I have said is number one at data literacy is the U.S. Army. Number two, and that goes for any private. I work at Nike, I've worked for BMW, I've chatted with Disney. Army is number one. Guess who number two is? A similar organization. It's Scottish Fire and Rescue out in Scotland. Isn't it interesting that you have a military and a fire and rescue service that are doing the best? It's not the private sector. So when you hear what the resources are and what you can do to develop, take advantage of them and harness them. And number two, the last thing I'll say is thank you so much for your service. Yes, I've been at West Point. I've taught the cadets out there. I go out there every year leading a train the trainer around data literacy. And so any opportunity I have, when I get a message saying, hey, can you travel out to Fort so-and-so and help, the answer is a big yes. So happy to be here.
Well thanks for that. Jordan, could you walk us through, you know, the four steps that you talk about or the four skills associated with the data literacy that we should seek to achieve?
Absolutely. And I'll give a little background of where this stemmed from. So all the way back in October 2012, there was a quote from Harvard. Anybody here go to Harvard? I'm about to rip into Harvard, so I can't offend people. Harvard actually didn't realize it at the time, but it bid a big no-no. And they said the sexiest job of the 21st century was the data scientist. So organizations then went out to go hire data scientists and didn't know what to do with them. And that kind of scaled back the industry some. And so all the way back in 2015, I was working for American Express at the time, and I ran a business intelligence group. And I would train people on what we were developing. But the way the training took place, and you might have experienced it at times, is I would train people on the dashboard. This is how you use the dashboard. That is not the same as training an individual on how to use data and how to make decisions with data. So I started to build a curriculum. And how many of you have seen The Big Bang Theory? It's one of my favorite. I'm a nerd, so obviously it's one of my favorite shows. But my leader was a lot like Sheldon. If you remember Sheldon, PhD, physics. My leader was a PhD in physics, socially awkward beyond socially awkward. I presented a new curriculum plan, and she told me no. She said, no, we're not going to train these things. Maybe in the future. They're not ready. So I put it on the back burner, but the thought never left my mind. And then I got hired by a company to build out data literacy, because that's what the industry and the world was ripe for. And so to his question, the four characteristics that you have to be thinking of, and they can actually be applied to now AI, right? It's not just data literacy, but now AI is everywhere. You don't need to fear it. There's a bunch of hype, a bunch of talk, but there's a bunch of practical application. And the four characteristics are the ability to read, the ability to work with, the ability to analyze, and the ability to, originally the definition said, argue with data. But that confused people. Like, are you arguing with your data? Are you positioning it? So we changed the word to communicate with data. So notice, again, data science is not in there. Coding is not in there. Math is not in there. It's this ability to be confident and comfortable utilizing data to make a decision. And as I spoke with the group this morning, we met for a while this morning, we were talking about one of the key terms you need to realize is data is just data. It just sits there. It needs you, a human, to help bring it to life. So those four characteristics, the narrative around it, the context around it, and then applying it to make decisions. If I go back to that weather app example, and you think about a weather app, you're naturally, you look at it, and it says it's cold, so you make a decision to wear something warm. Or you look at it, and it says it's sunny, and you look outside, and it's raining, and you know you need an umbrella. That's just intuitive. So when we think about data literacy, I don't want you to think of those four characteristics as new additions to your job, but augment and integrate them into your job as a part of what you do.
And if you could build on that intuition and how your experience combined with your data literacy leads to, you know, better decisions.
Yeah, so I think at times there is a misunderstanding that we say data literacy, the data should be saying everything. And that's not the case. I want your intuition. I want your gut feel. I want your experience. Because guess what that stems from? Personal, quote unquote, data points. The example I shared earlier today was Scottish Fire and Rescue. They're doing awesome. I traveled out last year in May, and it was like a three-day event. I was the only speaker for 3 days, so I did get sick after that event. the example I came up with is imagine you're a firefighter, and when you're fighting a fire, you hear a popping noise. And 8 out of 10 times, that popping noise indicated to you that the floor was going to collapse. So your gut feel tells you to leave. That's data. It doesn't feel like it because it's not numbers 1, 2, 3, and 4. It's not in an Excel spreadsheet or a database. But that is personalized intuition. It's personalized data, right? I'm a rugby coach. I love the sport of rugby. And as you're watching the game, you're basing off new decisions, strategic decisions, based on what you're seeing in the game that is probably based off of data or something you've learned. So to the point, it is the human plus the data that we want to be bringing to light. And I like the term to harmonize it. Right, we were talking earlier that there's two extremes. On one end of the extreme, you have only gut feel, don't worry about the data. The other end of the extreme is only worry about the data, forget the human. Harmonize those things. At some times, the data will overtake the human, and at times, the human will overtake the data. But over time, this is an iterative approach. And as it iterates, you're combining and harmonizing the human, yourselves, all of that. And Corinne, wherever, I don't see, where'd Corinne go? No, she's behind me, so no wonder I don't see her. But we were talking earlier, it's not just the data either. It is the human ability to be creative and bring the data to life and storytell. right? It is not. I was telling the story. I met with a CEO of an organization once, and I said, and it was a data vendor, how many data scientists are you going to have present to, like, your board or your C-suite? I asked him something like that, and he did this. And that's not fair. There are data scientists who can communicate. But the point is not lost, that a data scientist is trained on data science, not the arts, not on storytelling. So it's a holistic approach that needs to come to light when we do these things.
Yeah, and so I think the other thing that you shared this morning was, you know, the intuition combined with the skills that you described, right? And so what would you recommend beyond taking the courses that we're going to describe here in a minute? What would you recommend as practical application or practice to be able to marry those things together?
It's threefold. And if you've seen my TED talk or TEDx talk, it's two C's of data literacy, and I created a third because you're exactly right. It's one thing to learn all these things. It's another to then apply them in some sort of setting. And what the number one thing you could do is learn to ask good questions. Like you said, data literacy, my first C of data literacy is curiosity. I have five children. How many questions do you think I get on a daily basis? Way too many. And they know me, hopefully, as the dad who says, never stop asking questions, even though I tell them to shut up at times. But curiosity, right? Why does the chart look the way it does? This is an interesting one. We were talking about it earlier, and in the military and fire and rescue, you're taught not to question your leaders, right? You get an order and you go. That's not the type of questioning I'm talking about. I'm talking about if the data doesn't look right, or why are we seeing spikes in the data, or do we have enough of the medical personnel that we need, or what are the outliers? Number one, apply question asking with those four characteristics. Number two is provide creativity to the data. How many of you got up this morning and said, man, I can't wait to talk data literacy today as the number one thing on your agenda? Okay, I got a couple, and that one I actually believe right there. Hopefully we're making this more enjoyable, but the human element needs to come in from a creative perspective. Storytelling, data has been around since cave people said, eat this berry, don't eat this berry, right? And if I communicate it with my family, they know what you're safe, but my enemy over there, I don't need to communicate it, they'll go away. Data has been around forever. Storytelling has been around forever. How many of you think you, at some point in your life, had a genius level of creativity in you? Let me share a story with you. There was a longitudinal study done with, I believe, 1,600 children that at age 5, 98% of them tested at a genius level of creativity. Age 10, it went down to maybe 32%. Age 15, it went down to like 17%. 200,000 adults were studied at age 31 at a genius level of creativity, and it became 2%. So it was in us as children, to a degree, 98% of us, right? So we'll count me out and the rest of you were genius levels, okay? I call children data literacy detectives because they have this practical way of creatively trying to figure things out, right? And I understand organizations from the Army to private sector, you have policies, procedure. I'm not telling you to break those things. I'm telling you to get creative with the data. And then number three, my third C to apply to the four skills of reading, working with, analyzing, and communicating is please block off time every single day. Could be just 20 minutes where you don't look at your phone, you don't look at your computer, you block everything off, and you critically think on the data. If you want to get creative and see just how powerful our minds are, shut everything down, put a problem on the board that you're trying to solve, and think about it for an hour. And watch how many solutions you come up with. And then you apply those four characteristics to it, right? So we have 4 hours a day for our brains to do deep work. By show of hands, please don't raise your hands because you have people in here who might care. How many of you do not have a busy job? We all do, right? And so imagine now utilizing data and AI to augment you and to free up that hour so you can problem solve better. Notice I didn't tell any of you to go learn how to code. I didn't tell you how to do math. I'm not telling you to do any of that. Curiosity, creativity, and critical thinking.
That's very helpful. And so I just ask you all, and I'll go a step further, okay? While this is an Army organization, the professional dialogue from your perspective, helping us better develop a better solution to a problem is always welcome. I think I can speak on behalf of the commanding general and certainly the deputy commanding general as well. We don't want the stock answer. And if there's an error in what we're seeing and you've seen it, we need you to share it with us. And that critical thinking and your understanding of the data will bring that forward. Often referred to as the Napoleon's corporal approach in presenting that to leadership. So that'll be very, very helpful to us as well. You spoke briefly about AI, okay? And Mr. Lasher here, who's the G6 of our organization, did several LPDs on AI. Could you, and I'll set some context here. We will assume that we are able to build in a secure environment a large language model or whatever the generative machine is to help us. Walk us through how you have seen that, you know, increase efficiency and effectiveness in organizations that you've worked with.
Yeah, I can use one or two practical use cases, one from me and one from my organization. But the first thing I'll say is there is a lot of hype right now around AI, right? And whenever people look for clicks online, right? And so what you want to do is get behind the scenes to figure out use cases. And a use case is the key to everything when it comes to AI, because AI is an augmentation of you. So let me give you two examples of this. Number one, for me personally, I am the data literacy nerd. I'm the guy who helped pioneer this, helped invent it. But if I'm told you're going to go give a one-day workshop on data literacy, guess what I have helped me build my outline? Generative AI. I have it all up here in books and all these things. But I'm like, I'm going to teach at so-and-so company. I need an outline that's 4 hours. These are my six key topics. Build me an outline. But then I apply my human intuition, my knowledge, my experience to that outline for something that could have taken me 4 to 8 hours to build. I'm now done in 30 to 60 minutes. That is the power of generative AI, where it allows you to generate things. A second use case comes from the company that I work for. I'm their senior vice president of data and AI transformation, and they go out on sales calls, and they have to build requests for proposals, RFPs, that can take hours upon hours to build. Well, I had a guy, a gentleman who's tried to get me to buy his software for a long time. It was machine learning, and they've now had an LLM built on top or within it. So I said, okay, I want to test this against my request for proposal process, where we have hundreds of thousands of pages or whatever. So we took a small sample out of it and said, build an LLM on top of that. It's secure, it's firewalled, it's all that. And so then I was just talking to one of my guys yesterday, and he said, what could have taken 15 to 20 hours now takes 3 to 5. You are now opening up multiple hours to be creative, to dig deeper into the work. That's cost savings. That could be more sales coming through. And then you apply it here. Like a third example I could share is, now think of all the paperwork and information that TRADOC and the Army has. Imagine sticking an LLM on top of that, and you say, well, I need to create a personalized development plan for this type of soldier. Instead of having to go research and hopefully find the documents, you type that into an LLM, you get the outline, don't just run with it, and analyze it, communicate with it, interpret it, and create a new development plan. I think that's one of the powers of generative AI, is the customization that it allows.
Yeah, and I just want to reinforce the last point you made there. Don't just run with it. Then you applied the tasks associated with being data literate to it, which is huge. And the example of training development is one that we clearly appreciate in this command, and for which the Combined Arms Center is working now, and we hate using the word working. We like to say is on, milestone X versus milestone A. Okay, so but this is really important to us that we're able to figure out how to build a large language model and then have the skills by usums to be able to use it appropriately. And go ahead, sir.
One thing, I love what you're talking about, training and development, because I want you to now imagine an Army where a generative model is built internal here, and you are now customizing the training plans for each new soldier that comes along. That doesn't take much, right? I don't know, how many, show of hands, how many of you have ever used ChatGPT or Claude AI in those things, right? Just a couple days ago, I did a post on LinkedIn, and I used generative AI to generate an image. And someone's like, how'd you do that? I typed it in, right? I played with it. But to your point, now imagine an LLM on top of it, where you have specific dietary things that you can give someone who may be struggling with their health, specific fitness regimes that can do there. Sam Altman, and I think it's Arianna Huffington, are building a health app, large language model. Now imagine doing that here. The potential with the Army is amazing to me from that personalization.
Let's thread a little bit further, and we have a wearables pilot ongoing inside of the United States Army CIMT right now, and that data perhaps feeding that so that it is accurately tailored to the individual based upon the sensors that you have on your body. Great. Look, I'm probably going to ask one last question, then I'm hoping I'm going to get some questions from the field here, the audience in person or out. But I guess the last thing I would just ask your perspective on, okay, is as AI comes on board, okay, beyond having data literate individuals work it, what are some cautions that we ought to be concerned about as well? Okay.
Yeah, I think this is a very good question, because I am a big time optimist with AI, right? The ability to create and watch computational power bring things to life, poverty can be hit in a good way. Climate change, food scarcity, all these things can be solved, but there are issues. Number one issue is the data that feeds the AI, garbage in, garbage out. So there should be good data governance, AI governance there. Not only that, I think there's been this misunderstanding. There's a great book out there by Kathy O'Neill, I was telling them about this, called Weapons of Math Destruction, where it came out, this is all the way in 20, maybe 18 is when it came out, 19, and black box algorithms. Right? An AI is built off of data that might have been built by a human. And so when that occurs, those four characteristics of data literacy can be transposed to AI literacy. Are you reading the results correctly? Are you working with it and evaluating it right? Are you communicating with it? All of these things, not running with it. One of the biggest things you can do, there was an attorney that quoted a case or two or whatever that came out of AI. Those cases didn't exist, and I believe that attorney got disbarred, right? There was a Samsung employee who put code, IP, into an open model. Can't do that, because then the open AI gets out there. So when we work with AI, number one, we have to look at the data that's feeding it to make sure there's not bias, because it's built by humans and things like that. Number two, how many of you have heard the term hallucinations from AI? This is where the way a large language model works is it's reading all this data, and it's building a prediction of the response, and it gives you that response. Well, sometimes it hallucinates, and a lot of people fear that. Well, let me ask you this. How many of you think humans hallucinate with data? Just look at politics. They misuse data left and right, right? So you don't need to fear hallucinations, and you don't need to fear people using data as long as you're reading, working with, analyzing, and communicating with it well. And then to go on a bigger scale, there are concerns about AI with artificial general intelligence, which is where AI is us. And that's not too far away. And how do we cope with that? How do we work with that? When quantum computing, not to get too nerdy, occurs, what do we do with cybersecurity and AI when it can hack through all the models super quick? You have to build quantum security super quick, right? So there are those concerns that are further down the way. But the big ones for the here and now and probably the next foreseeable future would be ensuring the data that feeds it is good. But number two, as an individual, make sure you're evaluating the responses, you're understanding how to apply them, and if you don't research them, don't use them, right? You don't want to be the attorney who got in trouble because he quoted cases that did not exist, at least one. I shouldn't say cases. I think it was at least one, maybe multiple. So those would be the concerns. But the other thing that I don't think we need to fear quite yet is there's such a big hype around job loss. Yeah, industrial revolutions create change. So what I would argue is that we want to become more indispensable by taking the training that you provide here, by taking literacy courses, by getting more comfortable. I have lots of resources I'll send to the team so they can share out on books, maybe podcasts and things, just to get more comfortable with it.
So, again, just pick up on a couple themes. While AI is in our future, it isn't here yet, and we are working very hard. Mr. Lasher can perhaps have another session on this, that to bring in this secure capability large language model. But as Jordan said, and it applies right now, and I suspect the surgeon is struggling with this, is what is the authoritative data that you are using to come up with the questions and then the answers that help us go forward? Because everybody is going to question the data above us. It just happens. And when we can say we use the same data source that you use, then we're going to have commonality in that, and our recommendations will be more acceptable than if we've deviated. Last point to the job loss piece. Some of you may have been in here last week when we had a town hall, and I put on the screen the aggregate manning of TRADOC against our mission essential tasks. And you might have noticed the tasks on the right side of the screen as I was facing it were, below 50% in manpower, right? Wouldn't it be great if that 50% of manning in those tasks were empowered by artificial intelligence to do the tasks they know they have that they can't get to because they don't have enough resources to do them? The tasks aren't going away, and people probably aren't going to be any more, but if we had this kind of capability, they'd be able to be more productive in performing those tasks. So that's a way to fill in the holes that we have inside of our formations, perhaps.
I'll add to that. I love that last part. When you think about AI, think of it in two terms, augmentation and integration, right? There are areas where AI can fill in. When you do not have capacity, budgets are constrained, it's like for me, I would love to hire right now 10 data scientists. That's for my role and just do amazing analytic work. It's not going to happen, right? That budget is huge. But what if I hire one or two, invest properly in the right AI, and just say, I don't need you to write all the problems yourself, do all the modeling yourself. I'll let the AI do it. You two just supervise it. Much different conversation. So find ways the AI augments and integrates into your workflow.
Do we have any questions from the audience here? Excellent. Thank you for breaking the ice. Do we have somebody? There's a microphone there. If you want to stand up, please.
Am I on now? Okay. I'm Beta Moore, and I'm the TRADOC command librarian. And I have two pieces of information. So one, I want everybody to know that the Army University Library System does have Mr. Jordan's book, Be Data Literate. It is available as an ebook. And the headquarters TRADOC library here has a paper copy. There are we do have the other books, but it depends on where you're located within TRADOC, so you may or may not have access to it. The other thing I would like to say, and I don't know if TRADOC needs this or not, but I know the Department of Energy has an interagency agreement with other federal agencies to mint DOIs for data sets. So if that is something that TRADOC needs, I'm happy to have a conversation about what would be needed. It's not like I could flip a switch and make that happen, but there would be things that would need to be put in place. So I just wanted to put that out there so leadership is aware.
Number one, I will say this, and I will work to get this for the library. My first book has a second edition coming out next month, and guess what I added into it? AI. So the conversation with my publisher was, do I write a whole book or do we just add it to the first? So I'll see if I can't just get you a license for your library for an e-edition. That way you don't have to repurchase it. So, and I'm glad you saw your flashlight was on. I was going to tell you.
I thought you were so enthused.
Hi, I'm Kevin Tabor from the OCKO, Office of the Chief Knowledge Officer. Just to piggyback on that, when did you start writing your first book? What was your inspiration there? And who was your target audience to become the author?
Oh, man. First off, if you had told me I'd have four books by the end of this year, and I've already got my idea for the fifth, and I'll probably start writing, I never would have thought I would have done that. So I had talked to someone all the way back in maybe 2017 or 18, probably 18, about self-publishing and co-writing a book. And trying to self-publish was a lot harder than we ever knew. And he lived in Singapore, I believe it was, and I'm over here. We had an advisor in Australia. Logistically, that's a nightmare. It didn't work, right? And so I don't know if the thought ever left me to write a book, wanted to write one. I got lucky. So I was interviewed by a gentleman named Bernard Marr, who has, he's one of the biggest names on LinkedIn and dating. He's got like 2 million followers. And I became kind of a friend with him, and he interviewed me. And it just so happened that he was published by the publisher that I'm now published by, and they reached out. And they said, do you want to write a book? And I'm like, yeah, I'm in. And then they're like, okay, you have to submit a proposal still. So I was thinking I was in, and I was like, no, we have to approve everything. And it was a lot. It was like, I forget how many pages my proposal was and all of that. The target audience of book number one is everyone. And there's a story that I have about that. I love mountains. I love to run in the mountains. I've run multiple ultra marathons. And I was coming down a trail once, and someone I knew was coming up, and she said, congratulations on the book. I'm probably too stupid to read it. Something like that. They're missing the entire point, right? Be data literate is for everyone to understand, and hopefully, I mean, the coursework is based in the Army off that book, or a lot of it, right? And so it's for everyone to understand it, right? In fact, just yesterday or today, I did a post on it. I partnered with Chandra Donaldson, if you know who that is, CDAO of the Space Force. She's been acting deputy of the Air Force, a children's book, hopefully a children's series on data literacy. First book just launched. And so the inspiration, I'm a nerd, if you can't tell, I love this stuff. So I just like to write. An idea comes to me. I never knew I would like to write so much. If you're interested in writing, let me know. I've gotten multiple people book deals over the years with my publisher because I just turn them over to them and say, look, here's an idea. And if they like it and it's a part of what they're looking at, great. And if it's not, they might share ideas of what they're looking for. And we get book deals that way. But a book I recommend everybody read about writing is called Snow Leopard. And Snow Leopard by Category Pirates. It's the funniest authorship. It's a group of them. The only thing I don't agree with in the book is I don't want to self-publish. I love having a publisher take care of everything. They advocate self-publishing. And other than that, best book I've ever had. So if anybody wants to look into a book deal, just hit me up and I'll introduce you to my publisher or talk to you about it more.
Sean Rosh, TRADOC Quality Assurance Office. How would you measure data literacy in an organization?
So the measurement of data is a very interesting question because data, the way that it happens, is it integrates into processes. So attribution becomes hard. Data literacy is similar because what you're doing is you're teaching skills that get then applied to processes or applied to something else. So let's use a business example. I increase someone's data literacy, or I hope I do, who then uses that data literacy in a marketing campaign. How would you measure the attribution wall? So some of the things that I recommend you do is you set target metrics before the data literacy initiative happens. You can do an assessment of those that are about to take the data literacy course and content. They go through the content, you reassess. But you can't just reassess once. Because if you go through content and they test really well at the end of it, what if 6 months later they've stopped applying it? Where would their data literacy go, right? Talking about fitness, if you lift weights and do all that and you quit, what happens to your muscles, right? They're going to degenerate back down or whatever. And same thing with data literacy skills. We get good at what we practice. So I would actually create your data literacy program and in parallel, at least twice a year, run assessments just to see where organizationally it is. And then as you get further along in your data literacy journey, you might have data science assessments, you might have data consumer assessments, you might have different assessments that you create, but you measure it that way. And then number two is more intangible. You start to measure how much data is being used in decisions and you actually track it, right? When I was at Scottish Fire and Rescue last year, I met with senior leadership the day before the event and I talked to them. And then the next day or the day after, one of those leaders said to me, someone presented something to me, and she, I believe, if I remember right, asked them, what data did you use, or where's the data? They didn't have it. They made her go back and do it. So start to measure how much data is being utilized in decisions. Ask them for it. So I would do assessments, and then the intangible of measure where data is being used and how often.
You know, by the way, thank you. Quality assurance office.
Yes.
Major Drake. I work in Futures and Concept Center. We're the neighbor of TRADOC. So that was my question, but that means I can ask my second question, which is, you mentioned the Army is pretty data literate, and I'm curious what indicators gave you that impression that the Army is data literate. I'm not disagreeing. I'm just curious what
you
think.
So I'm going to clarify what I said. I said they're doing the best at data literacy. So that is a different score. Like, when you look at the metrics that are out there, I will say this. I have found the Army, compared to the private sector, extremely intelligent. And what I mean by that is there's a dedication in the Army to education. Whereas in the private sector, what you find is when they leave university, they get caught up in the rat race and all of that, and they just do their jobs. Whereas I think the Army has an ongoing knowledge base and growth. Now, to the point of data literacy, I'll share a couple metrics with you. With CLIC, when I was there, CLIC did a study. I worked for them, and I was the data literacy guy. And back in 2018, I think, is when we launched it. And it said around 1 in 5 people were fully confident in their data literacy skills. Then comes along March, I think, of 2022, and CLIC relaunched new survey results. Guess what that number went to? Any ideas? 11%, roughly 1 in 10 people thought they were data literate or were fully confident in their data literacy skills. It went backwards. Now, does that mean we became dumber? No. I think it became more cognizant of where our abilities really were. We had just gone through COVID, data was being released everywhere, so you had people who were probably tired of seeing data points or didn't understand how to read the data points. I would probably bet that if I went around and said, are you data literate? The answer is yes. I showed that earlier. Are you fully confident in your ability to use data in your position in the Army? It would probably be less than 10%. Now, if I asked that honestly at most companies, they'd probably say the same thing. So this is not some Army versus this or that. It's everywhere. There is not anywhere that I have found where everybody is just excelling in this. So what matters is a recognition and then action and plans to go forward and structure, which you're launching today here at TRADOC.
This program is for the Army. Well, it's for everybody inside of TRADOC and FCC as well. And I will tell you, I participated in about an hour session yesterday with the Commanding General in the Combined Arms Center, and specifically the Mission Command Center of Excellence. And the topic was, okay, what level of data literacy do we need at echelon in the Army? Okay, and principally focused on theater, armies, corps, and divisions, and what are the skill sets that need to be present there, and how do we develop those skills? And the answer at the end of the day was, we have to start when they enter the Army, okay? Because we have to get people comfortable with being literate all the way up. I questioned why a lieutenant needed to have it when on the battlefield a lieutenant probably wouldn't be using the data that we were trying to discuss. But in reflection and in counseling, okay, I became enlightened as to it really, really does start early. And so we are attempting here with the programs that we've developed to get caught up, right? And we as an Army intend to be bringing this in, certainly in the officer corps as part of basic officer leader training, and then through professional military education for the NCO cohort, warrant officer cohorts, and the civilian cohort as well.
And I'll add in, last November, I was invited to West Point because freshman math there, 103 or whatever, it was changed to be calculus heavy to data literacy heavy. That way all the cadets, so I was there for a week, I taught the freshman plebes, and I met with people in the department to help make sure the design of that class was appropriate, and they did a great job. And that way, to your point, one of the keys is, that if you remember, there are four characteristics. But the reality is, for a lot of people, it's just getting really good at asking questions. And number two, it's creating data fluency. Can we speak a common language around data, information, wisdom, all of these things? TRADOC, knowledge, doctrine. Are people, like, how many of you know what a Markov chain analysis is? Anybody? Hey, yes, my fellow nerds right there. But a Markov chain is a probability, essentially, analysis. If I say probability, people understand that word much easier. That's fluency. That's me going from the technical modeling into probability, which is a fluency modeling. And so these are things to be thinking of with all this training.
We food.
We got a couple.
Good afternoon, sir. As someone who has worked for the military both in uniform, as a contractor, and now as a government civilian, one thing I've seen that has evolved is the use of dashboards, for example, which brings me to my question. What are your views, and I'm specifically looking for do's and don'ts, best practices, with regards to data visualization?
Oh, yeah. I could talk a long time on this. Data visualization and dashboards are powerful and good for solutions as long as there is a purpose and an endpoint to them. There was an organization I met with once that had 200 or 400 dashboards, and guess how many they were using? Six. So why in the world are you maintaining all the others? And I would do the same thing here. One of the things that I would do is if you use dashboards, reflect on them and say, what information am I getting out of here? Does it tell a story? Right? And if it does, and you can tell me the purpose, then you're going in the right direction. If you've got human narrative, human context, all those things that are bringing insight to life, that you can make a decision. That being said, there are some data visualizations that just need to be descriptive analytics, which is the first level. It tells you what's going on. Sometimes we need that. But if you wonder why in the world you're either one, building a dashboard, and you don't know if anyone's using it, I advise this, but please don't get me in trouble. Stop sending it and see if anybody barks at you, right? Number two, instead of doing that, reach out to everybody you send it to and say, are you even using this, right? And maybe you don't go from 200 down to six, maybe you go from 200 to 20. But what you do is you pivot them. Data and analytics, dashboards included, need to not be set it and forget it things. They need to be iterated upon quarterly, okay? And that means sometimes you'll go with something for a long time and then you find it's not working, and that's okay. But always make sure you know what the intended purpose is, and number two, hopefully you can get decisions based off of it. If it's just a bunch of information sitting there, I'm beholden to a degree to say get rid of it.
Great question. Thank
you. Sure. Okay.
Good afternoon. My name is Jacqueline Blackwell. I work with DCSG 6 and with the KM superstars that you have producing this course this afternoon. One of my questions is, we as the Army and as other military organizations collect data about everything from everywhere. And one thing I've noticed is not all of that data is actionable towards decision making. And so I believe that the same data can be used for multiple frames of reference. Yep. Based upon the use cases and the human application of knowledge towards it. Is that your same perception?
100%. You'll hear me talk, especially with AI, because of all the hype that exists with AI, is it's use case based. And what I'll talk about here is I have what I call my four rights of data and AI. The four rights of data and AI are the right data and AI at the right time for the right objective with the right literacy. Those are the four rights. That can be one data set could fulfill 50 different things. And so what we really want to boil down to is good data governance, engineering, and architecture on the back end that solves multiple purposes. Because you're right, here's a statistic for you. I don't share a lot of stats. Back in 2022, it was predicted 180 plus zettabytes worth of data would be the annual data sphere next year. That's 21 zeros after 180. Guess how much data we're producing a day? A metric I saw not too long ago. 100 zettabytes a day. Okay, that doesn't matter. How many of that is pictures of cats and someone's dessert on social media, right? Same thing here, right? When you know what you're, we were talking about this earlier from a data strategy perspective. What is a data strategy? If it's full of buzzwords, it's not a good data strategy. Organization strategy is your data strategy. All it is how are you using data to meet your organizational strategy? Find the data that supports that. And you could have one data set that solves 1,000 things. But yes, 100% use case based.
Here in the front.
So, Brett Patient from CKO. So we talked about process.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about data supporting process.
Yeah.
What is the value of mapping processes to get data understood and in context?
Oh, I'm a huge believer structure and mapping matter, right? One of the things that ends up happening in organizations is you buy a tool or technology and you think, that's it, we solved the problem. A tool or technology is not a process or a strategy. It is a supportive thing. I'm a big believer to map out processes to find out purpose, context, narrative, applicability, and maybe the key word, feasibility. I think sometimes we forget that we have these ideas for this easy button, go do the sexy thing with AI, but it's a 5-year project that's not feasible with the resources and everything like that. So you can put it on the back burner. So to your point, process mapping, structuring things out, it's doing all the legwork up front to make sure your outcomes are good. Usain Bolt's quote or whatever, he trained, or someone said, or Usain Bolt said he trained 10 or 20 years or whatever to run for 10 seconds. Right? The 10 seconds is your analytical insight. The 10, 20 years or whatever to get there is your process mapping. It's your sourcing of the data, the cleansing of the data, the literacy training. And then you make it a part of you. And then that train gets rolling and you don't stop.
Hi, sir. Hugh Davis from the G149. So there's obviously there's an art and there's science in data. So my question is, as a leader, how do we build confidence and demonstrate confidence in the data that we're having? How do we as a leader put a test to it?
All right, I'm going to give two things here. Number one, there's going to be if you try and boil the ocean, you're going to run into problems. So create proof of concepts and wins and celebrate and share those out to the world if you're a leader. Share where it's working, where it's not working, and all that. And then I'm going to give you a formula that I have, because I think what you talked about with confidence is key. It's AI plus HI, your IQ, plus EI, your EQ, equals data analytics and AI success. And what I mean by that is, when so many people don't go to school to be educated in data analytics and AI, they might not have confidence, they might be fearful, they might hold back, they might do a lot of things that hinder the work right up. That's why emotional intelligence matters so much as a leader. Understanding everybody. The people side of this is by far the biggest roadblock to success. I can get clean data, I can buy great tools, I can do all of that, but if people don't want to use it, what good is it? So that emotional intelligence might matter more than any of it, because you can have a high IQ. How many of you have ever met someone who's really intelligent but horrible with people? Right? You run across it all the time. So that emotional intelligence from a leader is key. Understanding how people are going to operate with the data, how to make them believe in it, how to gain trust in it. And that's why celebrating wins, newsletters, community. This is a community, right? Utilize it for success. And when you have leaders that are behind it, march forward.
That ends the questions, and now you're going to do a little demonstration.
Yes, sir. I'd like to thank you and Mr. Morrow for coming today and sharing your experience and your expertise with us. I hope everybody found it as engaging as I did. We're going to take the last couple of minutes and look at the TRADOC data literacy program that we're rolling out today. And our goal is to create an engaging and interactive environment where we can all learn and grow together in this data-driven world. So I'm going to turn it over to Corinne Sibley to talk about that program a little bit.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much, Dr. Prevost. Next slide, please. Thank you. So what you're looking at here is the TRADOC Data Literacy Portal. One of the things that we are called to do as KMers is get the right information to the right people when they need it. And we recognized that there were many, many wonderful courses being offered across TRADOC. People were doing great things, including our friends from the FCC here. And what we did is we put it all in one place. So what you see here in the middle, Army Data Literacy Training, as well as executive courses, all of that information is right there for you to sort of be able to see and determine what you need. Because we have also recognized that not everyone needs the same data literacy training. It's not one size fits all. So we've offered that there. And then one of the other things that we did as we collaborated with really smart people across TRADOC in this field is that there was a need for sort of some baseline training to level the playing field so that you can take this 1-hour self-paced course. You can really understand why this is important to become more data literate, and also understand key terminology and definitions so that you're better prepared for a lot of the other courses that are offered. So I want to show you here to the left. After I kind of give you an overview, we're going to offer a QR code on the screen. We also have flyers at the front of the auditorium. But after you take that one-hour self-paced course, we strongly encourage you to take a look at our Data Literacy 101 course. So right here on the page, this is a public-facing page. You can go there, you can register for the course, and Dr. Prevost actually is going to teach that course right here on Fort Eustis. It's a three-day course, and once you take those two courses, you're really going to be better prepared to tackle your data literacy, and then, you know, learn more things about data, how to read, work with, communicate with data. So the other thing I will point out here on this page is our KM Academy. So like we've mentioned before, KM, you know, we're jack of all trades. We help you do your job faster, easier, and, you know, just really help you be more effective in accomplishing your mission here at TRADOC. So I encourage you to go to the KM Academy, where we have tools training, where you can learn things like how to create a SharePoint list, get your feet wet with some Power BI training, things like that. So please check it out. And what I'm going to do next, if we can go to the next slide, I promised you a QR code, so please scan it, check it out. It'll take you straight to the page that I mentioned on your phone. And one thing I don't want to forget to mention, you can learn more about Jordan's book there on the page. We've got his TED Talk. I strongly encourage you to listen to Jordan's TED Talk. It really did do wonders for me just to start to understand how to become more data literate. So thank you all for coming.
Karen, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And I've started the one-hour course.
And I encourage everybody else to do it as well. Yeah, it'll probably take me 10 hours. And you know, folks, please think about doing the three-day course with Dr. Prevost, okay? And supervisors, make time for your folks to do it, okay? This can only help us all get better in everything that we've just discussed today. And Jordan, I'm going to give you the final word here, but thank you. Thank you so much. This has been fantastic, and appreciate your genuine interest in the Army and sharing your vast experiences and knowledge with us. Over to you, sir.
Thank you for having me, and happy to travel out and do this. The last thing I will share is I am an open book. Connect with me on LinkedIn. You can email me questions. I will provide resources to the group. But I got connected with the Army years ago through a simple LinkedIn thing, and I've been advising and working with the Army for 3 years since. And so I'm an open book. I get invited to do these things with the military often. So just let me know what you need. And if you're even not knowing, besides doing this, what books to read besides my own, my publisher would like me to do that more, and I don't do it often. But no, I have other resources, other books and things, and thank you. Just connect with me. I'm happy to help.
For those of you who had questions online, we'll be getting with Jordan and getting the answers back to you online. Thanks.